From WNYC New York Public Radio, I'm Leonard Lopate. This is just one segment of the Leonard Lopate Show, but every interview is available on demand at WNYC.org. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org.
WNYC On Demand is supported by Open, how American Express serves small business. Open offers a range of products and services designed exclusively for small business. Details at 888-779-OPEN or open.com.
The evangelical Christian movement took hold in America in the 18th century, and since then, evangelicals have become among the most influential religious groups in the United States. Separately, Lauren Sandler and Jeffrey Sheeler traveled across the country to gain a better understanding of the modern evangelical movement. Ms. Sandler, who is the life editor at Salon, has written a book called Righteous: Dispatches from the Evangelical Youth Movement. And Mr. Sheeler, who was a contributing editor at U.S. News and World Report for 15 years, has written Believers, A Journey into Evangelical America. I spoke with them in September, and we're going to replay that conversation for you now. I began by asking Jeffrey about the negative stereotype of evangelical Christianity as a rustic religion that appeals mainly to undereducated Southern men, and whether there's any truth to stereotypes like that.
Well, you know, the problem with generalizations is that most generalizations aren't worth much. But that is certainly the, you know, we're talking about 60 million Americans here. And just about anything you can say about evangelicals has some germ of truth. The problem is that the way that they tend to be represented in the media, with obviously some exceptions, has tended to promote that kind of stereotype.
Well, you must take it personally because you are an evangelical, and when a reporter like in the Washington Post says evangelicals are poor, uneducated, and easily led, I'm sure you ask, well, what about me?
Right. Well, what I say is that I'm a former evangelical. I no longer consider myself an evangelical in the traditional sense, but certainly my personal connections are such that when I hear those kinds of things, it just strikes me that I know that's not the way it really is.
Do you say that you feel this type of media portrayal has been harmful to the movement? Why harmful?
Well, whenever, you know, someone says something about you that's not true, I think it's harmful. People who are non-evangelicals, which of course is most of the world, they construct their opinions of people by what they read, by what they hear, and so inaccuracies obviously can be harmful.
Lauren, you traveled around the country and interviewed many teenagers who you feel are at the center of the modern evangelical movement. Do teenage evangelicals consider themselves part of the political side of evangelicalism?
Many of them do. Many of them do shun the word political, period, and really like to think about their politics as something which is more connected to their beliefs or their lifestyle. But some of the kids who say that are full-time anti-abortion activists, people who campaign very actively for candidates, you name it. I think it's the word political which is the problem.
Well, do they come to it, to these beliefs, from somewhere else, or there's a new film called Jesus Camp, which I don't know if you've seen it.
I have.
But in that, kids as young as 5 years old are sent off to camps. Actually, first they're homeschooled, and then they go to camp. And at a very early age, they are being told about the evils of abortion. And at one point in the camp, they bring out a cardboard figure of George Bush and are told to thank the president for all the good things that he's doing. Kids being politicized at a very early age by adults.
That does happen. There are many people I met who do feel a lot of love for George Bush. There are many people I met who feel like George Bush is not nearly conservative or fundamental enough. But I think that, as Jeffrey was saying earlier, there really isn't a single evangelical experience out there. People are brought into it in a variety of different ways. It's something that, you know, skate punks get into by meeting skate pastors when they're skateboarding near their high school, or kids come into it a rock show, which is thrown by evangelicals.
So you get punk rockers. Religious punk rock.
That's the new stereotype. It's replacing poor, uneducated men all over the place as a bunch of kids with tattoos and skateboards.
What attractions does evangelicalism have for people engaged in what we normally think of as anti-authoritarian lifestyles?
Well, I think that the attractions are myriad and very interesting. I heard so many kids tell me that the secular world simply fails to provide what they need in their lives, that we are a land of consumerism, that kids are tired of being marketed to, that they feel no place or home in the world. And they have joined a movement which has offered them meaning and purpose and community and identity where they have a really hard time finding it elsewhere.
Is that what happened with you, Jeffrey? You said you're no longer an evangelical or practicing anyway, but you weren't brought up evangelical
either.
No, I
wasn't.
So you became an evangelical in some degree to rebel against your parents, didn't
you? That's the way I describe it, yes. My family was conventionally religious, I suppose. I mean, they weren't regular churchgoers, but I was raised to believe in God and respect the Bible, even though I'd never read it and didn't understand it. So as a teenager, it was my separation from my, coming up with my own identity as opposed to that of my parents. And I chose to find it in Christian fundamentalism.
Do you see that as happening, Lauren?
That happening all over the country.
So this is, it can be, in some cases, it's a rebellion in the opposite direction from what we normally think of as teenage rebellion.
Exactly. I've met many kids who talk about, you know, the moral relativism of their parents, the scourge of the 60s, the notion of what it means to live in a godless world that their parents inhabit. But at the same time, there are also plenty of kids who grew up in the church. It's just interesting that there's now this movement which is bringing these rebellious kids together with these fresh, scrubbed Christian kids.
Did somebody proselytize you, Jeffrey?
No, I wouldn't say so.
I fell
in with some good kids. I mean, you know, I had the people who I was attracted to as friends in junior high school happened to be Christians, and they invited me to, you know, Youth for Christ rallies and are you going to church anywhere and that sort of thing, and so I eventually became a part of that. But I'm glad that Lauren pointed out the fact that while certainly there were people like me and like a lot of the skateboarders who are sort of rebelling and finding something that was missing, and it's sort of a statement against the commercialism and materialism of society, there are a lot, and I would venture to say probably a majority of evangelical young people today have been raised in evangelical families and choose to go to evangelical colleges, and by no means is it a statement of rebellion or rejection of society.
My guests are Jeffrey Scheler. Am I pronouncing it
That's
right?
That's correct. Very good.
Scheler, who was the contributing editor for Religion at the U.S. News and World Report for 15 years. His book, Believers, A Journey into Evangelical America. Also, we have Lauren Sandler, who is life editor at Salon, and her book is Righteous Dispatches from the Evangelical Youth Movement. Both of the books are published by Viking. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You call some of these kids the disciple generation. What do you mean by that, Lauren?
What I mean by that is I do personally believe, after my travels and reporting, that this evangelical youth movement is truly what will come to define a generation of people between, say, the ages of 15 and 35. You mentioned Jesus Camp before. Obviously, this stretches far younger, but I was really focusing on teens, people in their 20s, young parents in their 30s, as a group of people who are really brought together across demographic lines into a single belief and a single ethic.
And they don't really subscribe to organized religion in most cases.
In some cases, again, there's this range. But yes, there are plenty of kids who refuse to go to church, who call that four walls Christianity and rebel against the notion that you would do one thing on a Sunday and then live Monday through Saturday in a different lifestyle.
You suggested earlier that these are kids who in many cases are turning to evangelicalism because they've been abandoned by an overwhelming world. They just feel there's too much hedonism out there, and they can't handle it?
I think hedonism does play a role here, but I think more importantly it's, you know, the amount of information out there, the global age, the internet, the age of terror. It is a completely overwhelming time to be a human being walking through the world. And it's a hard time as well, I think, unless you are, you know, decently educated, have a love for books and ideas and discourse, to really figure out what you believe right now. And this movement offers kids something to believe.
But hasn't the movement changed a lot, Jeffrey? It has become more politicized. In recent years, we have Pat Robertson, T.D. Jakes, Paul Morton, Creflo Dollar, President Bush. They've all become associated with the evangelical movement. How is it different from the religion you practiced when you were born again in the 1960s?
Well, in the 1960s, we were coming to the end of a period, really, of isolationism. The word evangelical really wasn't even used much at that time. They're very proud of the term fundamentalist. I went to a fundamentalist church. We didn't call ourselves evangelicals. But about that time, really kind of developed what is called, has since been called, the neo-evangelical movement. And it was really led by people like a young Billy Graham and some others in the early 50s. And basically these people were fundamentalists in their theology, in their belief system, but felt that the isolationism of the previous 30 or 40 years was a mistake, that evangelical Christians needed to engage the culture at all levels, intellectually, politically, certainly religiously. And out of that has developed several manifestations of political involvement. Some are those that you've mentioned, but there are others, and they're not all conservative Republican.
In fact, there were the ministers who signed on to an environmental plea, an ad that ran in the New York Times, who said, "We're not like those other people." But the movement has become largely associated with the religious right in recent years. Would you say that the religious right and the evangelical movement are inherently different, or are there good reasons why so many evangelicals identify with the goals of the Republican Party and not the Democratic Party?
Yeah, well that's certainly true. The religious right is a subset of evangelicalism. Not all evangelicals would identify with the religious right.
And many probably vote for Democratic candidates.
The U.S. News did a poll prior to the 2004 election, found that 25% of evangelicals either were Democrats, identified themselves as Democrats or leaning Democrat. You know, don't forget, 7 million of them voted for John Kerry, not an insignificant number. Other polls have found that up to a third of evangelicals are considered moderates or swing voters. 55% of them voted for Bill Clinton both times. So, you know, we're not talking about a political monolith. Now, that being said, of course, you know, 78%, when 78% of evangelicals vote for George Bush, I mean, that also is a very significant number. But they're not all marching in lockstep politically.
And it seems that much of the reason for this political change has to do with certain moral issues in their minds. Abortion.
Yeah.
Now, abortion was once the big issue of the Catholic Church.
Right.
When did it become a major issue for evangelicals?
Well, it took them a while. It took them a few years, really, to get on board with that. And, I think abortion is certainly one of the issues that really, I would say abortion and same-sex marriage are two issues that tend to galvanize evangelicals, even those who would consider themselves moderates, or there aren't many who would actually call themselves leftists, although there are some. But when it comes to economic issues, war and peace issues, there's a tremendous amount of, you know, there were a lot of evangelicals who voted their moral values in 2000 and 2004, and they didn't vote for George Bush. But certainly those two issues that I mentioned, abortion and same-sex marriage, are certainly galvanizing issues within the evangelical movement.
And why do you think same-sex marriage is so important?
Well, you know, I think if you listen to someone like Jim Dobson, who I sat with for a half hour or so one day in his office in Colorado Springs, he, I think, probably describes it fairly well when he says that, you know, it's not just for him, it's not just a matter of what people do in the privacy of their bedrooms. For him, it's a matter of what this is doing to the concept of the American family. And, you know, young people coming up, being raised to think of the family in terms of completely wide open, whatever you want to think of, however you want to define it, it's okay, do your own thing. He and a lot of evangelicals see that as a real corrosive situation in terms of the future of the American family. I mean, right or wrong, they feel very strongly about that.
Lauren, in your book, you write about a church, the Mars Hill Church, that incorporates popular culture into its evangelical services. Even heard references to Snoop Dogg in one sermon. But does that mean that abortion and same-sex marriage are not big issues in a church like that?
Oh, absolutely not. As I mentioned earlier, this is a generation that does not build walls between politics and culture and faith and lifestyle in any way. These are completely integrated ideas to this disciple generation. And so in my travels, in my conversations with literally thousands of people, I would say by now, over all of these years that I've reported on this, you know, I think I found maybe two people on the road last year who had voted for John Kerry. Plenty of people didn't vote for George Bush, but they did vote for religious right candidates because they thought that George Bush was not extreme enough. When you travel through the South,
what was their objections to George Bush?
That he simply wasn't.
I mean, he might talk the talk, but he wasn't walking the walk.
Yeah, exactly. And they were, you know, happy that someone was at least talking the talk. But for a lot of these kids, you go all the way or you're not doing it at all. I mean, there is that level of extremism in terms of belief and politics here. And, you know, it was really interesting to travel through the South and meet a lot of young black voters who are children of the civil rights movement, whose parents, you know, are still voting Democrat. And every single one of them that I met would talk about abortion and gay marriage and say that they would never, ever vote for a Democrat.
That was something that was predicted a while back, mm-hmm. that because of these issues that black conservatives ultimately would wind up moving over to the Republican Party. That despite the fact that the Republican Party often seems to be resistant, at least as we saw recently in renewing the Civil Rights Act, some members of the Republican Party are resistant to civil rights issues. That's not important to these kids.
This is not a generation that thinks in terms of civil rights. To this generation, that's their parents' issues. And those issues are part of what has created a culture that people feel no place in and are rebelling against. And so this has created a whole generation of single-issue or double-issue voters who are completely focused on those very ideas and are, frankly, in my experience, I've seen them led there by their pastors.
My guests are Lauren Sandler, her book, Righteous Dispatches from the Evangelical Youth Movement, and Jeffrey Sheeler, his book, Believers, A Journey into Evangelical America, both of them from Viking. We will continue our conversation after this. Back with two authors who have books with Viking. We have Jeffrey Sheeler, whose book is Believers, A Journey into Evangelical America, and Lauren Sandler, whose book is Righteous Dispatches from the Evangelical Youth Movement. And you focused on the young people, and you give me a sense that if now the evangelicals are split, maybe more conservative Republican than in the past, this next generation will almost be 100% conservative.
It does seem that way. And what's really interesting to me is, you know, this fundamentalist faith and this right-wing politic is exactly what is uniting people across all these different demographic lines.
Where does this the latest craze, forgive me for saying this because I know it goes back a long time, I remember Reverend Ike here in New York, but we're seeing it in some evangelical churches that God wants you to be rich. Where does that come from? Ministers like T.D. Jakes and Creflo Dollar become very popular with that message, and they've also been very connected to the White House.
Well, as you say, it's been around for a long time, and it probably will be around as long as there are people and money and religion.
I guess, but it just recently made the cover of Time magazine,
right.
So we're thinking about it more. And also, it's something you see a lot on television.
You do. And I would say, though, that in my travels, I've found that, as we said earlier, you can find just about anything within the evangelical movement. And I think the prosperity gospel is one that's been preached quite a lot in various places and in various times, but neither today nor really ever has it represented what anyone would consider to be mainstream evangelicalism. I mean, we see it on television. Well, that's sort of a self-perpetuating situation.
But T.D. Jakes is a powerful minister. He's one of the most popular in all of television.
Yeah, and so, you know,
has hit records. He has movies.
You buy yourself some airtime, and when you have airtime, you have a way of collecting money, and the people who have the megaphones, their voices get heard.
Is this something that the kids are interested in, or is that something that only happens to evangelicals when they wind up having to pay the mortgage?
Oh, no, this is a big thing for kids. The way that I discuss it in my book focuses on Creflo Dollar, who has the fastest growing church in America right here at Madison Square Garden, remarkably. The way that I discuss it is focused on the Black Prosperity Church and really looking at how an entire hip-hop culture has put incredible financial success front and center. It's every rap video, it's every rap lyric practically seems to be about money or about Jesus.
But wasn't Jesus's message being, giving to the poor?
Sure, but
in fact, the Judeo-Christian tradition is largely about that.
Absolutely, but the prosperity gospel is a very selective gospel, and it is one that I think is represented more by pastors' lifestyles than by what they preach out of the Bible. If you take Creflo Dollar, he has two Rolls Royces. He flies back and forth between Atlanta and New York every week in his private jet. I think that his own success tells his congregation, I'm a believer, and look at me.
And the same thing happened a couple of decades ago with Jim and Tammy Faye. You know, they were basically preaching a prosperity gospel. We saw their end. We saw how that story ended. Prosperity gospel preaching, of course, has not ended. But we see where it is likely to lead.
But in that case, it was just because they were selling more shares than they could sell. They engaged in criminal activity, at least for a little while. Or Jim Baker did. Tammy Faye never went to jail.
Right.
In fact, she was a very charming guest on the show some years back.
And interestingly, Jay Baker, the son of Tammy Faye, is really quite an epilogue to that story. Jay has now renounced this sort of financial success, is covered in tattoos, and is preaching out of a rock club in Atlanta where his moniker is Revolution, which is the name of his church, destroying religion since 1994.
Destroying religion.
He's deeply anti-institutional, like the rest of this movement. The idea is that religion is the enemy of this faith.
So it's easier to become an evangelical nowadays because you don't have to join a church. You just have to declare yourself a believer and subscribe to certain ideals?
Though historically that has been a lot of the appeal of evangelicalism, the notion of the personal relationship with Jesus, something which is unmediated by an institution. So that's always been there. I just think that this generation is really running with it.
How do you see this as similar or different from the awakening that George Whitfield led in the early 1700s and from the second revival in the 1890s. Is this a third great awakening?
Well, it's been called that. In fact, some people call it the fourth. I don't know where the third one. I missed one, too. But yeah, you know, I think in the beginning, certainly in Whitfield's time and Wesley and Jonathan Edwards, they were countercultural. They were countercultural, and certainly at least in terms of anti-institutionalism. You know, the Church of England was nothing if not institutional. And what the appeal of the evangelical message, which was preached by circuit riders in the Second Great Awakening during and by Whitfield and others in the First, was a message preached outside the four walls. You know, no longer was the Christian faith to be brokered by the clerics. It was something that was to be acquired in a personal transaction between a believer and a believer's God. And it was very appealing on many levels. And some people would say that it was tapped into the same sense of independence and personal responsibility that led and fed into the American Revolution.
Can we say also the counterculture of the 60s? Because in the 1960s, most homeschoolers were actually people who had dropped out of the system, not for religious reasons, but for other reasons. And now most of the homeschoolers are evangelicals. But in many cases, they look just like they are old hippies.
There certainly
they dress
are elements
similarly.
Of that.
They yes. subscribe to many of the ideas mm-hmm. that the hippies did in the 60s. Is this, in an odd way, an outgrowth of the counterculture of the 60s, you think?
Well, the way I look at this is that I see the 60s happening all over again, but not on the secular left this time, on the religious right. But that's particularly looking at a youth movement. I see youth on fire for this, kids who are connecting culture and politics in a way that they haven't since then, who are organizing at rock festivals, who are abandoning institutions in favor of this faith.
Now, when you say a rock festival, we're not talking about the same rock festival that other kids might go to. These are Christian rock festivals,
they
aren't
are.
They? How similar are they? Would people notice much difference if they didn't listen to the lyrics?
In some ways, they wouldn't. I know Jeff and I have both attended these rock festivals. There are at least a dozen of them all over the country every single summer, like mini Woodstocks that draw thousands and thousands of people who go and camp out. And in many ways, yeah, it's kids with tattoos and tents and loud music. However, these festivals have really become quite crucial to the grassroots organizing movement. And there are people who go to do activism at these festivals and run seminars at these festivals. In a way, it's sort of like what Woodstock could have been if people were sober enough to get activism started there.
Is that part of the appeal for these kids, that they don't have to go to a church, that they go to something that's more their sort of thing?
Absolutely. And this is actually something that all of these awakenings happen to have in common. Historians of great awakenings, particularly a man named William McLaughlin, who is sort of the awakenings dean, if you will, have often written that before an awakening hits critical mass, it has to reach the youth culture. It has to be translated into a new version of itself, that the old lights who promote this, the Billy Grahams in one generation, the James Bakers in the next, need to be outmoded so that things can be redefined and so people can redefine themselves. And I do think that that's a strong part of why we are part of this awakening right now. And just yesterday, George Bush called this the Third Great Awakening. So finally, George Bush and I have something that we agree on. But I do think that in tracing the arc of this awakening, of which we're all part right now, looking at the youth movement is really crucial.
Well, one of the big differences is that these kids support the government and its institutions and support the military, even though they may not all be enlisting in the military, whereas in the 60s, teenagers were rebelling against those establishments.
Yeah, you know, I think that if you, I don't know if Lauren found this, I know she found it in some places, but the places, some of the places I visited, for example, I went to Wheaton College rather than Patrick Henry, where Lauren visited, and Wheaton is...
But Patrick Henry is mostly kids who were homeschooled.
Homeschooled, primarily that,
and now they're
yes.
working in Washington. I remember reading right. those that article in the Times Magazine. Is Wheaton a similar situation?
Wheaton has been around a lot longer, has more of a tradition, more of a history. But one of its traditions also is the kind of cultural engagement that the neo-evangelicals talked about in the 1960s, late 1950s. And so what you find at Wheaton is really a lot of young people who are from the church. They're born, raised in the church for the most part, are very culturally engaged, very aware of what's going on in the world, and feel that they want to be a part of solutions. Many of them are involved in politics, not all. I would guess a very high percentage. But you also have a very high percentage of students at Wheaton who go on a semester or more to a foreign country working among the third world poor or whatever it might be, not to organize politically, but just to do plain old-fashioned development, humanitarian work.
But what about these colleges? I remember being told when I went to school that one of the functions of a college is to challenge the ideas that I brought with me. Are these schools challenging the things that these kids are bringing with them? Are they teaching intelligent design, or are they teaching them evolution?
Well, they're teaching intelligent design. I know that at many evangelical colleges, if not all of them, and you can correct me on this, Jeffrey, but faculty needs to sign a document before they begin teaching that says that they agree with a certain credo, which is often quite fundamentalist, and often one of the elements that one has to sign off on is saying that you believe that the Bible is the Word of God, period, and that you will only teach what supports the Word of God. So intelligent design is completely out, but plenty of other things then are often out as well.
Jeffrey, go ahead.
There may be some colleges that believe that way precisely, but I think what normally happens, certainly all evangelical colleges have some sort of a faith statement that they require of their faculty. Usually they will say one of the standards of evangelicalism is inerrancy. They believe in biblical inerrancy, basically that the Bible is free of errors, or at least in its original autographs, which makes it all kind of meaningless because we don't have those any longer. But nonetheless, faculty has to subscribe to the notion that the Bible is free of errors. That is not the same as saying that they believed that the Bible should be interpreted literally. And so the theory of creation or young earth creationism, that the earth is only 10,000 years old and was created, you know, in a miraculous instant, that is not something that most evangelicals subscribe to or require of their faculty or their students, and they certainly don't teach it.
Some people have seen similarities in the various fundamentalist religious movements throughout the world, claim that American evangelicals, at least the more extreme ones, are no more tolerant than Islamic fundamentalists. Has that ever been discussed with any of the people you've talked to?
Well, you don't find, interesting, unlike in the 1960s when I was a fundamentalist, you don't find many evangelicals today who want to even consider that they might be fundamentalists. I mean, it's just a term that has gone out of fashion. Mm-hmm. And so you don't find many evangelicals who are willing to defend the notion of fundamentalism. They certainly, however,
but the rightness of their beliefs.
The rightness of their beliefs, but they would not want to equate, they would not want to equate their style of religion with Islamic fundamentalists.
But isn't that just a semantic issue around the word fundamentalism? If you believe that the Bible is inerrant, that means that you literally believe in fundamentalism.
Well, fundamentalism is a term that has a very precise meaning and a very precise history. And it came out of, you know, there really are no Islamic fundamentalists. Fundamentalism is a Christian term that goes back to the early part of the 20th century.
I think Jerry Falwell would call himself a fundamentalist, but he is not an evangelical. He's a Baptist. So there we have other distinctions that are being made within the various Protestant groups.
Well, Jerry Falwell also stopped using the term. He no longer calls himself a fundamentalist. What he might think in the privacy of his own home is something might be something different, but he does not publicly claim that title. It's a term that is out of fashion. But you're right, Lauren. There are certain key things have not changed. You know, the kinds of issues that the early churchmen wrote in the early 20th century that they wrote in a series of pamphlets called the fundamentals included things like biblical inerrancy, a belief in the Trinity, belief in the virgin birth, sort of the classic Christian doctrines. And that hasn't changed. What now separates modern neo-evangelicals from the old fundamentalists basically are stylistic things. Much of it has to do with, how you engage culture, almost an air of belligerence. Certainly the fundamentalists were isolationists. The evangelicals are not. So there are very real differences that have much to do with style, attitude, perhaps even politics, but not so much religion.
But it is my sense that this is the future in America. Or is this just a fad? I think I'm going to have to leave it there, unfortunately. We've run out of time. I think this is something we'll all have to think about. Her book is called Righteous Dispatches from the Evangelical Youth Movement. Also with us has been Jeffrey Sheeler, whose book is Believers, A Journey into Evangelical America. Both of them are published by Viking, and I want to thank you both so much for being with us today. It's been a really fascinating discussion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Leonard.
And this is New York Public Radio, WNYC 93.9 AM 820 and WNYC.org. On tomorrow's show, Elizabeth Edwards talks about being diagnosed with advanced breast cancer while her husband was running for vice president. And then ABC correspondent Lynn Scher reflects on her 40 years in the media. And cultural critic Robert Hughes talks about his car accident and other scenes from his eventful life, plus Phil Ramone, the legendary hit-making record producer. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenda Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to the Leonard Lopate Show from WNYC, New York Public Radio. You can hear everything we do and check out our other programs on demand at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This on-demand service is made possible by WNYC and its listeners, so please help support this free service by becoming a member at WNYC.org. And thanks.